Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Tonight I'm with Dave Eggers and Valentino Acek Deng in the Creative Arts Building on Tiger Lane, just following their public discussion of the 2015 Memphis Reed selection, What is the What?, a novel Eggers published in 2006 with the subtitle The Autobiography of Valentino Acek Deng. The book was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction, even though it tells the true story of Valentino, who trekked 1,000 miles as one of Sudan's so-called lost boys, seeking refuge from a horrific civil war in Sudan, first to Ethiopia, and then to Kenya, and then to the United States. How can Deng's autobiography be a novel by Dave Eggers, you might ask? Here to help me figure it out are Dave Eggers and Valentino Acek Deng. Welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So rather than ask you, Dave, to talk about your work, I'm going to do the unobvious and ask Valentino to do that. Valentino, you've come to know Dave Eggers' body of work pretty well. He's one of America's most important living writers, but he's also an editor and publisher, founder of McSweeney's, an independent publishing house, and co-founder of the literacy organization 826 Valencia, which inspired the Crosstown Arts Program Story Booth here in Memphis. For listeners who haven't already explored Dave Eggers' expanding cosmos, Valentino, can you give them a little introduction to Dave?
Yes, but I would caution you that introducing Dave Eggers is not an easy thing. He has done so much work, so much accomplishment, and such a vast network of people around him that if I try to introduce him in the kind of this setting, I'm afraid I would do him injustice. But the Dave I have come to know is a very kind, down-to-earth friend. I have worked with him. I have also read a number of his books. Some he wrote before I met him. Many came later. He's someone who loves educating. He loves learning. He exposed himself to very dangerous situations sometimes, like I went with them to Sudan when there was still civil war, and we flew maybe the 1900 aircraft. He's a writer. He's a family man. I have known his family. And even most recently, he has become a soccer coach for his kids' school. So you think of him as a writer, but he's also someone who had a basic life like everybody does.
You mentioned in your comments at Rhodes and also tonight that Dave's first book, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, which is his own memoir, was the story of a lost boy, that you connected to that story. What did you mean by that?
Well, he has done things that I also have done at a very young age. He has to take care of his brother, who was 8 years old. And you can imagine two siblings wondering, trying to make both ends meet. They've lost their parents in a situation where no one should. In America, it's very difficult to be an orphan. The loss itself is tormenting. Leave alone is struggling to leave and keep the family legacy. I went through that also. I was separated from my family. They have not died, but I could not reconnect with them. I also have to take care of younger friends of mine. And even now, as I speak to you, I have become a breadwinner for my family. And he was doing that. We have a lot in common than we even thought of early on.
So Dave, let's talk a little bit about your relationship. You talked tonight a little bit about how you were introduced to Valentino. Can you tell us a little bit of that story, and specifically, what made you decide that it was his story you wanted to tell?
I was recruited. I was minding my own business in San Francisco and working on a collection of short stories at the time. And I had read an article by Sarah Corbett in the New York Times Magazine about the Lost Boys, and I just had a general awareness, but I was not seeking out to work on such a project. And I got a letter in the mail one day from Mary Williams, who was the head of the Lost Boys Foundation in Atlanta. She invited me to come to Atlanta to meet Valentino and to talk about the project of writing his story, and she thought that we would make a good team. And I went as a journalist, not really expecting to get deeply involved. I thought maybe I would write an article and spent the weekend most of the time with the three of us. And I think Valentino and I just hit it off. And I felt, as a journalist, it struck me as a story that hadn't been told with the depth and scope that the story deserved. And even in a weekend of interviews, it went so far beyond anything that had been reported in the media about the so-called Lost Boys. So I sort of got pulled in step by step over the course of the next many months. And it was probably 6 months in when I think we made a really firm commitment that we were going to do this and make a book out of it, even though all along I hoped to help in any way I could, but I had no idea it would take 4 years and involve so much, quite the scope of work that it did.
And you talked a lot tonight about the thousands of hours of interviews that went into the whole process. And one of the things that stuck with me was you mentioning there's a difference between a short version of a story and a long version of a story. And one of the things that's so compelling about the book is the level of detail, is that it does take 550 pages just to get this early part of your story. Valentino, in telling your story, Dave Eggers inhabited your voice, and he penned this work as if it were an autobiography. When you reread sections of What is the What Today, do you hear your own voice telling the story, or do you encounter a fictional voice narrated by a character named Valentino Acek Deng?
I hear my own voice. If you come to know me well, I'm not easy when it comes to communication. So I bring into English language also my traditional way of telling stories. Not a lot of details are given. You have to search details on your own. And in What is the What, we had to get into those details. To give the story a narrative, there are some areas where it has been stretched to get the level of detail that make it readable to the readers and also help people understand the chronological accounts of events. You have to imagine dates and times and years. If this story has to be told as it happened, it would have been several books or series of books to get to the core details of my life.
Even the story that is told, it's a story of stories. And Dave, the form of the novel is really key to the story it tells. In What is the What, you tell Valentino's story by having him tell a whole series of stories. So the book is a nested set of stories inside stories, which thematizes storytelling itself. And you're exploring what stories get told, who gets to tell them, who hears the stories. Why was this form important for Valentino's autobiography?
In part, it was the way that we went about the process, because we weren't in a room together every day, and we would get together from time to time, but a lot of it was on the phone. And each time we had an interview session, it would be really about a particular moment, whether it was first leaving home, or first arriving in the U.S., or first arriving at Pinudo, or if it's about the Royal Girls of Pinudo. And they were episodes that we would cover, I think, in any given session. And maybe that lent it to these discrete sections that are told in flashback or told in stories within stories. And also, I think that, you know, it was the way that when I would interview and talk to other friends of Valentino's and family members, there were always discrete stories too, that each had beginnings and middles and ends. And I think it was just the form that made sense. Everything about the novel, I always think any story has its most appropriate form that it finds its way to one way or another. And this book took longer than anything else I've ever done, and it was more difficult to arrive at that. But this happened to be, as unusual as it is on so many levels, it happened to be the most appropriate form to best tell and honor Valentino's story.
You ended up framing the story within a 24-hour period in Atlanta, with Valentino first telling his story to the couple who mugged him in his apartment, and then to the attendee in the hospital, and finally to clients walking into the gym where he worked. Why fold the whole thing into 24 hours.
What struck me about Valentino when we first began the process, and there was an assumption that the Lost Boys of Sudan, and when they were resettled here, the young men and women, that they were immediately both embraced and granted the opportunity for, or maybe granted outright, a better life, and it would be much easier than life in Kakuma. It wasn't always the case. And there have been incredible success stories among the young men and women who were resettled in 2001, and Valentino is one of them, but it wasn't easy. And they had to immediately figure out how to pay rent, how to get a job, how to try to go to school while they were paying rent and getting a job, community college. So many of the young men and women were doing two to three different jobs. Valentino was working at Best Buy and then later in the back room of a furniture warehouse, you know, sorting fabric samples. It was not glamorous. It wasn't an easy transition. And then while we were working year after year, it still wasn't getting easier. I saw my friends still struggling, and it wasn't so easy just, oh, well, I'll take a few classes, then we're going to, you know, he'll easily get into a four-year college with a scholarship. That wasn't happening. And so it was important to me that my first draft or outline had the book ending when Valentino gets on the plane, lands in Atlanta. It's instant glory and transformation. But because it took 4 years to work on it, I saw the day-to-day struggle. I saw the hard work he was putting in. I saw the frustrations. And I thought, well, that has to be part of the story too. And then when Valentino and I talked about when he was mugged and he was working at the health club and he was waiting for hours for service at the local hospital, all of these mundane struggles that proved that it was not coming any easier year after year, I thought that that had to be part of it because we're talking about the immigrant experience that is struggle after struggle, and I thought people had to understand that. So it seemed to me the right way to frame it, so that we don't have it just be, you know, some triumph of landing on the tarmac in the U.S., but more about the day-to-day struggles of even the most gifted and celebrated of immigrants.
Valentino, I want to ask you if you think that the form of the story was important for an American audience, since most Americans have no idea of the 2.5 million people that were killed or the over 4 million people displaced. And when you hear these numbers, they really are so staggering. It's clear that we should know this story. In the book, What is the What, Though?, you write that the Civil War became to the world at large too confusing to decipher, a mess of tribal conflicts with no clear heroes and villains. But the form allows the story itself to be told. So do you think it was important for an American audience to frame it this way?
Yes, it was important not only for an American audience, but for the Western audience. This story, if it wasn't told this way, maybe it would not have gotten in the hand of many people. We are sure that the story is attracting an unusual audience to read an African story, which also was the very reason I wanted to reach out to the readers with details, because normally you would hear a report by journalists or newspapers would publish something once and it's gone, and sometimes with not enough details. A story that would only evoke a certain emotion at a given time, but not in details. With the book, you have to tell more, and you have to tell it in a way it will reach an unusual audience that would understand it, connect with it, and have something to do with it. And that is the reason even the book had to be a fictionalized biography. You could call it a biography or a fictionalized biography, but it was stretched to meet the purpose of getting the readerships understand it.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm talking to Dave Eggers and Valentino Acek-Deng about What is the What?, the selection this year for the Memphis Reads program. Valentino, tonight you mentioned one of the stories, one of the moments in the text that I found really interesting, and let's just highlight one story that you tell in one of the shortest chapters of What is the What, chapter 11, which is about the abduction of slaves by Sudanese Arabs and the redemption of those slaves and the problems that it creates. Tell us a little bit about slavery in Sudan during the Civil War, since I think many still believe that slavery was left behind in the world sometime around the U.S. Civil War in the 19th century.
By 1984, the government of Sudan had armed a militia called Murahalin. And Murhal in Arabic means to displace someone and take over their land. The Murahalin are known today as Janjaweed. The same kind of militia had operated in South Sudan before the Darfur conflict. And some of their activities involved abducting young girls and boys, and they work in their farm, they marry them, they kept as slaves. They were not abducted to be even conscripted into the army, as it is a common thing. It was a pure slavery. And when I went back to Dave, we actually did a book that maybe a lot of people do not know. It is called Out of Exile. And some of my own cousins who were abducted were among the women we interviewed. And I remember breaking down in tears, in stress, just hearing them talk. Here is a woman who was abducted, have six children with a man who abducted her. Actually, the guy who abducted her originally was fought and killed. And now she is redeemed and brought back with six children. And you have a story where money was paid to get her back, but not a lot of money was paid to sustain her with the kids. And her name was Achol. And actually went on and hired a number of these young women to work at the school because they could not find any job. That is a slavery. In my village, we still are missing many people who were taken into a slavery. It was actually, by the time I came to the U.S., the United Nations Security Council had just voted that there was no slavery in South Sudan. And I know it. It exists. It's a reality.
We interviewed three women who had just been returned, and they didn't speak Dinka, even though they were from the area, because they had been abducted so young that they were taught Arabic and they had their names changed and were forced to convert to Islam. And one of those women had left three kids up north and had just been brought back, but their future was very dire. They, you know, they had been taken when they were 5, 6 years old. Women were taken and made to be concubines and sold between militiamen and higher members of the military. Boys are taken for farm work and made to be slaves. And it was going on all during or during much of the Civil War. And the consequences are still being felt. And these people are still being repatriated. And Gashol, who still lives nearby in Mariobai, who we always see when we're in town, she's still struggling. But it's unconscionable, the fact that it was going on.
There are more people living in slavery now than at any other point in human history. A lot of people don't even realize it. Dave, let's drill deeper into what you brought up earlier about the immigrant experience, because listening to Valentino talk about America these last 2 days made me want to Venn diagram your views on America, because Valentino, like many immigrants, you're very optimistic about the U.S., and that's in part because you're putting it into perspective. But in What is the What, part of what readers confront is the disparaging and often hostile treatment of immigrants, whose stories we often have no idea about. This is a theme you've explored in works, in other works of yours, Dave, like in Zaytoun as well. What did you want to highlight in What is the What about how immigrants are treated in America? And this, obviously, in the context of a political campaign where this has become a major issue.
Yeah, it feels like it's, you know, it's so sad right now. Some of the rhetoric that's being thrown out there, mostly by Donald Trump, and he's fanning the flames of sort of latent xenophobia that sort of lives within people, communities all over the country, and it just needs to sort of be brought forth sometimes, and people, and they get stirred up again. We're very quick to remember that we're a nation of immigrants, and then we're very quick to forget it. I'm both so proud of the United States as a haven for immigrants and asylees and refugees, because I think we do a fantastic job with so many new arrivals, and the Lost Boys and Girls of Sudan being a good example of how well and deeply they were embraced and quickly embraced by communities all over the country, especially churches and community groups and groups like the Lost Boys Foundation that sort of filled in some of the gaps that couldn't be executed well by some of the, you know, the NGOs that had brought them over. But at the same time, I think that we always can do better. I think that we mistreat, you know, scores of other groups. I think that I personally believe immigrants are the bravest people on earth, and I think that we need to honor their sacrifice and honor their hopes. And we think that we need to feel honored as a nation that they came here for a better life. And if they so believe and so want what we have here, and that we as a nation, you know, somebody was born here, I was just given it. So if somebody sacrifices everything and travels thousands of miles and endures, you know, untold hardships to get here, I feel like it's my or anybody else in my position's duty to help ease that burden a little bit, because I was given it to it. I was given these things at birth. I'm sometimes frustrated with when we fall short. But at the same time, I really do think as a nation, we do a very, very good job generally, especially embracing groups like the Lost Boys and Girls. I think that we have to be more compassionate, especially right now, the arrivals from Mexico, Central and South America. I feel like again and again, you see these groups, their rights being violated. As workers, they're exploited. I think we published a book called Underground America that explored this very well. And so I'm just like Valentino, I'm optimistic too, and I'm quick to point out all of the great things that we do, but also when we fall short and can do better, that needs to be illuminated too.
Valentino, you spent 10 years or more living in Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya. One of the most memorable lines from the book for me was, "There is a perception in the West that refugee camps are temporary." I want to ask each of you to comment on that line. Valentino.
First of all, for a refugee camp to be established, it is usually established in another country, in a host country. Nobody is considered a refugee when they are in their own country, meaning their own homes. You are either a displaced, internally displaced person, or you are a refugee living in a foreign land. In my case, I lived in Western Ethiopia in refugee camps. The military regime was overthrown in 1991 and had to go live in northwestern Kenya in another refugee camp called Kakuma. And, you know, Kakuma became home. The more the conflict lasts in South Sudan, the more we considered staying in the camp, and the camp became home. There were schools, there were health centers, there were programs, technical schooling programs, there were even distant learning universities open at the camp, and a new leadership was being made among those who left their countries and have lived in the camps. So a refugee camps can be a home, and it should be treated as a place that provides a solution to the people who have been displaced and have left their countries. In the language of America, you are brought in and integrated, and you're given a job's credentials so you can seek job and work and expect it to stay here and start a new life. That is also what happened in refugee camps in other countries. That should be the plan. It should have a time limit, but when it doesn't, it becomes, refugee camps becomes homes.
You know, there's another line in the book. It says, "Kakuma was, we were first told, the Kenyan word for nowhere." So what do you think about people living in refugee camps for more than 10 years? And refugee crises are yet another thing that are happening throughout the world, Dave.
It's so incredibly complex. I don't know if we can solve it here. I think Kuma was 80,000 people. And no matter, even if, you know, the U.S. took in first a number of Somali Bantu arrivals, and then they took the 4,000 Sudanese. That did something to, you know, alleviate the numbers at Kakuma and give an opportunity to a lot of groups. But even then, Kakuma is still, how many people are there now, Valentino?
Kakuma has over 100,000. It's a refugee camp that have been there since 1992. So we're talking about nearly 20 years now when this camp was established. It has a number of major NGOs working in the camps, and it is a home to an increasing number of displaced people.
Again, when we visited, because we visited that same trip, it's a bustling, lively place with its own economy, and were able to run small businesses, and so many people are. There was obviously the challenge of affording people the opportunity to grow their own food, and there wasn't land. There are restrictions that I don't necessarily agree with in a lot of camps, where they don't have a plan for self-direction and autonomy and for self-sustenance. But they are built as temporary havens, and they aren't necessarily, the infrastructure doesn't exist for the long term. And so I visited a refugee camp in Djibouti a few months ago, and it was the same situation where there was not a long-term plan, but nor did they think that there should be, because this was a temporary solution to the crisis in Yemen, but it leaves a lot of the refugees who are there without a next step. And I think then we get into the problem of whether or not asylees can apply to a third country rather than the country of first entry, which is a thing I don't agree with at all. If you go to Yemen and you end up in Djibouti, why should you only have Djibouti as an option for asylum? But that is the standard. A camp like that, or any camp, should have, I hope, a lot of infrastructure, a lot of options for the residents to get out, whether it's third country solutions, whether it's asylum, whether it's, so many people from Kakuma ended up going back to South Sudan when the war died down a little bit, but here we are again. But at the same time, I really honor and respect the work the UNHCR does, and they do it with very little money and very difficult circumstances, and they're caught in the middle. And so Valentino has done a lot of work to support them and in gratitude for what they've done. So I don't think that there's any one solution, and there's certainly not just anyone to blame. I think it's one of these things where on the ground you have to come up with solutions that work individual to individual, camp to camp, and try to do your best in a very extremely difficult position, because here we are in an era where there's more movement, more refugee crises than any time in the last 50 years. So
you talked about the meaning of the camps, of the name of the camp. We gave the description we have in the book is one where the refugees themselves started describing Kakuma. It is not the meaning of Kakuma for the Kenyans. We just found a camp was a desolate place. It's in a semi-arid zone, dusty, no water. There are no big trees. And it was just seemed like we were in the middle of nowhere. So we thought the Kenyan must have a meaning for the camp. And the meaning we thought is the one in the book.
And I think when you said, you know, these are cobbled together in situations of crisis, of course, and so there isn't necessarily a plan about what the next step is. I think one way you can parse the title amongst many different meanings that it has, what is the what means you're unclear about what the next step is. Last question. In his Wall Street Journal profile, Dave Eggers unplugged, Howie Kahn places you in the tradition of activist novelists like Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer. Dave, do you think that's a fitting epithet for you, activist novelist?
You know, I, like anyone, I would resist any title. I don't want to be categorized in some way. I don't want to have a badge that I have to wear or a business card that has my name and activist novelist underneath. Because you want the freedom to do anything you want to do next, you know? The book I just published is a children's book about the Golden Gate Bridge. I wouldn't put that as falling into that category. So the categories are for other people. It's valid to help understand anything, concept, place, a people or a person. It's nothing that I would use as self-description, but, you know, that said, I don't mind the term activist, and I write novels, so I'm a novelist, I guess. The two of them with a hyphen in between seems limiting or maybe too prescriptive, you know, and I always think of Hemingway's line, if you want to send a message, send a telegram, you know. I feel like I don't want to ever be sort of limited that way or have it. People feel like if they pick up a book by me, it's going to punch them in the face with some ideology or message. And I think that, you know, I always try to provide all the human nuance and contradictions and even ironies, even in a situation, a story like Valentino's. But again, I don't shy away from the term activist. I do feel like that's, I'd be honored to be called that. And I feel like we should all be activists for whatever we care about. That means that we act. So if we care about something, how can we do anything but act? And if we act, we're activists.
Dave Eggers and Valentino Acek-Deng, thanks so much for being with us on Counterpoint.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening.